It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Central Time, we'll explore the history of the snowmobile in our Wisconsin Legend segment.
But first, you might be wondering what to do with your old TV, computer, or other gadget now that Santa brought you a new one.
A new survey from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources shows that while many people are aware that you can't send your electronics to the landfill, few people know what to do with them instead.
Sarah Murray is the e-cycle coordinator for the DNR. She's here to tell us what we can do with our old gadgets. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So maybe a lot of people are clearing out space in the basement to put their old appliances or old gadgets while they figure out what to do with them. What can they do to get rid of those electronics in an environmentally friendly way?
Sure. Well, around the state, we have a number of collection points where people can drop off their electronics for recycling. We call it the eCycle Wisconsin program, and electronics manufacturers help fund the cost. So there's a network of close to 450 sites around the state.
And how can I find a site near me?
We keep a list on the DNR website. So if someone goes to the DNR website and searches for eCycle or just Googles eCycle Wisconsin, you can get to our page. And we keep a list organized by counties, so you can put in your county or maybe a neighboring county if you're right on the border and see what sites are available.
This is a fairly new program here in Wisconsin. What was the problem? Why is it bad if this stuff ends up in a landfill?
Right. Well, electronics are one of the fastest growing parts of our waste stream. You know, it's still not a huge amount compared to some of the other things we throw away, but if you just think about the number of electronics you have in your home, both working and ones you're not using, it's really grown over the last decade or so. And there's a couple problems with putting them in the landfill. One is that some electronics do contain materials that could be harmful if they got into the environment. We want to handle them properly, things like lead and mercury. And then there's also a lot of valuable materials that can be reused in electronics, so we don't want to waste them. We want to be able to recapture the plastics and metals and so forth and put them into new products.
So when we go to the site and hand over the goods, what happens after they leave? How do they get recycled?
Sure. So electronics collected through this program in Wisconsin go to a small set of registered recyclers. These recyclers have to meet certain environmental and worker safety standards. Most of the electronics in the program are initially disassembled in the upper Midwest, Wisconsin and our neighboring states, and a few others elsewhere in the U.S. So the recycler will take apart the electronics into the different components, and then they'll market those. So metals might go to, you know, local scrap metal yards or programs. Plastics might get sent overseas where they're getting made into new products. Some things like, say, circuit boards go to really specialized smelters that are able to extract small amounts of precious metals from them. So they really become commodities that can be used again.
Are there other programs that do this outside of this state e-cycling program? Are there stores or other agencies that are doing similar projects?
Yeah, so when I talk about eCycle Wisconsin, that's a program that electronics manufacturers help fund. So it often makes the cost a little bit lower. And as part of that program, we have a lot of retailers participating, like Best Buy, American TV, Staples, Office Depot. So a lot of electronics retailer stores will take those back. A lot of Goodwill stores participate in the program, and a number of communities and other, you know, waste haulers and other small for-profit businesses. So it's a real mix around the state of places you can take them. And then outside of the program, there are certainly some others collecting electronics, especially for some of the smaller devices that we tend to replace more quickly, like cell phones. There's a lot of reuse programs, too.
And there have been some concerns. I think there was a 60 Minutes piece a couple of years ago. People worried that e-cycling isn't as environmentally sound as we'd hope, as we'd think. What you mentioned earlier, environmental regulations on the agencies doing this or the businesses doing this. What's in there to make sure that it's fairly environmentally friendly?
Right. So, you know, one thing we look at first is to make sure the initial recycler materials are going to is responsible. So that recycler is meeting federal worker safety standards, environmental standards, they have any permits they might need, and that they're really taking care to handle the materials properly and safely, and also protecting data security, which is another concern a lot of folks have. And then under the eCycle Wisconsin program, those recyclers have to keep track and let us know where they're sending the materials downstream. And so they have to do some due diligence to make sure they're sending them to responsible places. A number of recyclers also have third-party industry certifications now, which requires them to go through extensive auditing processes and really look carefully at where they're sending any of the materials from these electronics to make sure it's not just ending up in a dump somewhere.
I mentioned at the outset a survey from the DNR finding that a lot of people do want to recycle these things. They don't want to send them to the landfill, but they don't know what to do yet. Are you seeing rising awareness of the state's e-cycling program?
Yeah, so the program's been in effect since the beginning of 2010, and certainly since then we've seen awareness increase, but it's still not quite where we'd like. So, I mean, Wisconsinites have recycled a lot under the program. They've recycled close to 123 million pounds since January 2010, so that's a lot of electronics. And we know that there aren't that many people putting them in the trash. Really, it's more an issue of, you know, them being stored in our attics and basements and closets. So our survey found that while about 60% of folks are aware that they can't put them in the trash, there's also still a lot of people who aren't sure where to take them. And that might just be, you know, if you haven't decided to go recycle a TV, you might not have, you know, figured out where to take it. But we really want to make sure folks know that there are a number of opportunities, so you don't necessarily have to wait and hang on to them forever.
Do you have a target at the DNR for how big a success you want the e-cycling program to be?
I guess we look at it a couple ways. So each year, electronics manufacturers have a minimum target they have to meet of helping to pay for the recycling of a certain number of pounds, and that's been right around 30 million pounds a year. Now, there might be more electronics than that, so our main concern is making sure that folks do know where they can take the electronics and that they're not putting them in the trash each year.
And tell us again the website, the best way to find where we can take these things, and maybe we can start digging our attics and basements out a little?
Yeah, so just Googling the words eCycle Wisconsin or going to the DNR website, you can get to our website and find a list. Folks can also check with their local community, too. A lot of local communities might have more detailed information. But we keep that up-to-date list of all the permanent sites. And then especially, you know, if folks aren't quite ready to clean things out yet as we head toward spring, the spring cleaning season, there'll be a lot of special collection events around the state, and especially in some of the more rural areas. Sometimes that's the best option. There'll be these collection events once or twice a year.
One of the longest lines I've been in was at one of these. It was a free bring whatever you got, your old gadgets, and I did exactly that. I hit my basement closets and my attic closets, those old circa 1990 computer supplies I had sitting around.
Yeah, some of these one-day collection events get a huge response, and so that's a great option. But, you know, if you're out, you know, redeeming gift cards or doing other post-holiday errands and you're happy to go by a Best Buy or a Goodwill or something, that's another option, too. So you don't necessarily have to wait and sit in line at one of those events.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for your interest.
That's Sarah Murray. She's the e-cycle coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. By the way, we have a link to that website at WPR.org/Central Time, or you can go to the Central Time Facebook page to get a link to that information.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for our Wisconsin Legends segment, and today we're talking about not a person, but a thing, the snowmobile.
That's right. Believe it or not, the snowmobile was invented right here in Wisconsin. And here to explain how this machine came to be invented in the Badger State is Joseph Kapler. He is the curator for the Division of Museums and Historic Sites at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Joe, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
I want to start out with what happened before 1924, and we'll get to why that's an important date in a few seconds. So in 1924, cars were still were kind of popular in Wisconsin. There were roads of some kind, and you could drive around the state. We had lots and lots of snow, though. So what happened in the winter when people needed to get around in cars?
Well, if you didn't have a sleigh for your horse, or the snow was too deep for your horse, perhaps you were trekking it on foot in snowshoes. Or you simply didn't travel as much as you would when there wasn't all the snow, especially in the deep snow of the Northwoods.
And some people, though, would take their Model Ts and they would sort of put, I've seen some pictures of this, where they would put them on skis and sort of ride on top of the snow. And then in 1924, the story is that Carl Ellison hurt his foot and designed something totally different. So talk about kind of what he did that was so different and then how that morphed into what we know as the snowmobile today.
Certainly. Carl was an avid hunter and fisher and trapper, and like a lot of his brothers and buddies, would out in the woods an awful lot during the wintertime. And with a disabled foot, he really couldn't keep up. and kind of in his own words, he decided, well, if I can't join them, to beat them. And he thought of always tinkering with ways for better winter travel in the deep snow. And so he himself was slapping some skis on the front end of a Model T, and that could work again on established roads or trails. But that vehicle wasn't really nimble for in the timber, in the woods. And so what Carl's 1924 invention, where it stands out, is he made something solely created on its own. It wasn't an adaptation of an existing vehicle, and it was far more nimble to be able to get, not only on the trail, but off the trail and into the woods, especially if you're a trapper and checking trap lines and things like that, or a hunter especially. And so he took a little bit from here and a little bit from there. So pieces of a Johnson outboard motor, a radiator from a Model T, skis, rope, cobbled it together and made what he called the motor toboggan. And this is just a simple description.
And it's interesting, though, because you said it was nimble, and I've seen photos of it. And the original one still exists, right?
Certainly, and that's a great story. We a couple years ago at the Historical Society Museum, we did an exhibition on major Wisconsin innovations, and trying to find that alpha artifact, right, the first one. No one ever sits around in a lab and says, "Eureka, this is the great X or Y, and I should preserve this for some curator down the road." You know, things always get morphed or tossed out, but the original 1924, from which he received a patent a couple years later, exists. Virtually the same as it was then. And if you're up north, about 6 months a year, it's at the Vilas County Museum. The other time, it's at the Elison's, their hardware and lumber store right there in Saner, on display. So, as a curator, that is just wonderful that original is still around. You can, get right up to it and check it out.
And I have to say, though, that original one does not look very nimble.
It wouldn't be as with our 21st century understanding of snowmobiles as we know them, with their high performance. They look like they would be a little tippy, kind of a high center of balance there. Yet they could still, reach speeds that I would be scared to death on one of those. But considering what else the choices were at that time, that was a great step forward.
And it was a step forward, but, it did not stay in one place for long, right? I mean, as I understand it, he built a pretty successful company, took an order for 40 or so that wound up going to Finland or someplace like that, but worked very hard at improving them. What sorts of things was he doing to make those original motor toboggans more into what we know as a snowmobile today?
Yeah, I'd say he's first and foremost kind of a tinkerer and innovator. And so in his very small shop up there in Saner, he continually made about 15 or so of these machines. And so all hand-built, trying to reduce weight, trying to get a little better engine power, a little better traction, maybe a little bit on the underside to increase potential flotation if you're going out over the ice. So tweaks here and there, a little more creature comfort, maybe even a windscreen, and then that was throughout the 1930s. And then as World War II production ramped up, I think he realized that he wouldn't, even if big orders came, he wouldn't have the capacity to fulfill them. And then he entered into a partnership with another Wisconsin company, Four Wheel Drive Corporation out of Clintonville, west of Green Bay, who had a greater production capacity. So he assigned his patents to them, and they had the production rights, and he received royalty. And so then from 1941 on to 1946, 47, all the production, they still branded them Elison motor toboggans, but that was done out of the Clintonville facilities of four-wheel drive.
So back in those early days of snowmobile, we all know who rides snowmobiles now. You put them on a trailer, you take them up north, you go out in the woods, and you have a good time. But these were not necessarily, these were not machines for recreation. These were machines for work.
A lot of the serious hunters and trappers, that's their wintertime livelihood. And you read some of the contemporary customer referrals and people talking about how they can travel 120 miles of trap lines in a day, unheard of obviously with foot on foot. So not only that, but then able to get supplies, medical supplies or food to remote areas, able to check things like power lines in the winter, which would be very susceptible to damage from snow and ice storms. So certainly probably considered more functional. And today, obviously, with our better roads and motor vehicles, the snowmobile is probably more first and foremost a recreational vehicle, but I don't think that was necessarily his intent from the beginning.
So when did that shift start to take place in Wisconsin, where you saw the snowmobile kind of evolve and from being just a workhorse, you know, kind of a tractor for the snow, if you will, into something that is used more for recreation, for racing, or for just going out on a trail and having a good time on the weekend?
In the late 1940s, Four Wheel Drive Corporation shifted their production to a Canadian facility, and yet they're still branded Elison, and they were ramping up size, multi-passenger, larger engines. You could, and then also marketing the speed aspect that you can really get out and fly on the snow, and there's the fun part of it, definitely. And then other makers, manufacturers entering the marketplace. And I think once you saw in the early 1960s when switching the engine from front to rear and then providing put most of the weight right over the traction on the back and really be able to have high performance at speed, turning, up and up hills, that type of thing, and the snowmobile, and more makers, and designing some just cool machines, cool-looking machines with great names. Polaris was directly influenced by the last model of the Elison, and so you see all these things coming together. And so in the 1960s, the snow would then primarily became called the snowmobile. It's a better marketing name than a motor toboggan. Sounds
I'll
faster.
Give it that.
Sounds
yeah.
funner, more fun. And so about that time is when you see kind of the shift.
And some of those names that we all know, like Skidoo and Arctic Cat and Yamaha and so forth, is there any Elison name still associated with snowmobiling?
Certainly for the folks, you know, the collectors and the enthusiasts, there are Elison motor toboggans at museums around the country, not just here in Wisconsin. But the first is here in Wisconsin. I think that's just fantastic. But there are numerous museums around, and they're highly collectible, those early models. They pop up every now and then. And then if you're up in Vilas County, hotbed of snowmobiling, stop in for folks who know the name. You know, you can still go to the Elison hardware store there, like I said, and see not only the 1924 machine, but others as well, kind of a little mini museum in there. And the Vilas County Museum, the time that it's open during the year, has an excellent collection of not just Elisons, but other other snowmobiles as well.
I know they do this a lot with vintage race cars and with vintage motorcycles and so forth, but in the winter, will they bring out some of these old vintage motor toboggans and start them up so people can get a real sense of what they looked like and what they sounded like and what they smelled like?
You know, that is a great question. I've seen some historical footage, but I haven't seen some contemporary footage, and I do not know the answer to that. I would imagine that some folks who are collectors as well as tinkerers who have the ability, like any old technology, it's one thing to have it. It's another thing to be able to know how to operate it and keep it up and running and still remain vintage.
So are you surprised at the number of people in Wisconsin who don't realize that the snowmobile has its origins right here in the Badger State?
We learned a little bit about that when we did the Innovations Exhibition a few years ago. And this is one of those things where you mentioned the snowmobile was invented in Wisconsin. So, oh, well, yeah, sure, okay, that makes sense, of course. That seems logical. Yeah, maybe Wisconsin, maybe Minnesota, something like that. But I think for the most part, unless you're kind of an enthusiast, you wouldn't know the name Elison. And so that's the types of stories that we try to get out there as well. It's certainly a significant story because snowmobiling is a major part of wintertime activity in North America, and so it's a major Wisconsin contribution. And maybe it's not so well known, and that's where we feel we can kind of shed light and give these stories a broader, higher platform.
Well, thanks for telling us about the snowmobile today.
You're very welcome. And folks are ever up north in Saner, it's a neat little stop there at the hardware and lumber store and to check out. Even if you don't like snowmobiles, if you like old equipment, it's pretty cool.
Sounds cool. Joe Kapler, curator for the Division of Museums and Historic Sites at the Wisconsin Historical Society.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up later, we talk with a guest who argues that the members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court should be allowed to pick their own Chief Justice.
But first, we take a look at the history of Boxing Day, a holiday that many of us see on the calendar year after year, but maybe can't explain it or know what we're supposed to do.
Luckily, we have Canadian historian and author Judith Flanders here to help us out. She is the author of The Invention of Murder and Inside the Victorian Home. Her opinion piece, Boxing Day is Forgiving, appeared in the New York Times. Judith, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I want to start out with the basics here because we have three people in the studio here. And during the break, we were talking about what we thought Boxing Day was. And not surprisingly, we came up with three different descriptions that none of us were, our voice kind of meandered off after the first.
And what were they?
Well, one of our colleagues in the studio actually lived in England for a time. And she says people there told her that it was when the wealthy people received box lunches.
Okay, bad, no.
Another one was that another person in the studio referred back to that episode on MASH where the people switched jobs for the day after. So Colonel Potter was doing Klinger's job and that sort of thing.
Okay, next.
Okay. My theory is something to do with gifts of some kind. And I'm not sure where the box reference comes from, though.
Okay, you're closest.
Yay, good for me.
Yay. Boxing Day is officially the first working day after Christmas, but basically it's the 26th as far as we're all concerned. And when Christmas began to be an important holiday, which was in the 19th century, in the Victorian period, Boxing Day was the day afterwards when the service people, either the servants in the house or the tradesmen, were tipped by the richer people, and they were given Christmas boxes. Now, these weren't real boxes for the most part. It was money. But it was simply a way of referring to a gift.
So how did the meaning of it get so, or is it as lost in other parts of the world as it is here? And America is just sort of floating out all by itself, not knowing what's going on.
Well, different places have different things. I mean, even in Ireland, it's not called Boxing
it's
Day.
It's St. Stephen's, right?
It's St. Stephen's Day. But there is still a connection because St. Stephen was, he's the one in, you know, the Carol Good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen, so the day after Christmas. And he saw, the reason it's connected with St. Stephen is Stephen was connected with giving and with charity. So even then, the link is always to giving in some way. Now, that is completely vanished in terms of how we actually celebrate the day today. Basically, it's the equivalent here of, I'm sorry, I can't quite remember what you call it there, Black Friday?
Yes, Black Friday, the biggest shopping day of the year. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's Black Friday. Everyone goes to the sales, which is not a hugely charitable endeavor. That's really all people do on Boxing Day, or they go and visit the relatives that they didn't see on Christmas Day.
So when did that start to change? When did that idea of giving to either those who worked for you or those less fortunate change into something, you know, the stores are giving me a deal, so I guess I'll go take advantage of it?
Well, I think that we've kept the giving has translated slightly into what I think you do in the States as well. You know, you give your service people, whether it's sanitation workers or whatever, a Christmas tip. Anyway, we just now do it before Christmas for the most part.
So
in the run-up.
So go ahead.
So the idea is still there in that sense. The charitable idea exists, although it's now more about the season as a whole. I mean, lots of charities here run Christmas appeals, and I'm sure the same is true there.
So the idea is there, but in reality, it's a shopping day. So in America, there's the day after Thanksgiving, there's a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth about, you know, we've lost track of what Thanksgiving is for, and this consumerism is running rampant. Are there similar discussions that take place in other parts of the world in boxing?
There are, but of course, the great joy of being a historian is finding out the patterns. And the earliest reference I've seen to a newspaper weeping and wailing about Christmas becoming commercialized and we've lost the true meaning was, I think, 1840.
Okay. So at least we've got a history of losing.
I'm quite sure the shepherds at the Nativity were going, well, in my day, it was much less commercial.
No doubt. So one of the questions I have is, so, you know, there's a lot of British origins in the U.S. Why didn't that Boxing Day tradition, we could always use an extra day of shopping, I guess. Why didn't that Boxing Day tradition make it across the pond over here?
I think probably because it developed rather later. Certainly the earlier tradition Christmas is basically a 19th century invention. The Anglo-American Christmas is 19th century. There's very little that comes from before that. The Puritans weren't very keen on Christmas. So the American tradition for a long time followed that. And I think that the difference between Boxing Day now and then, perhaps, is that for the early part of the 19th century, when Christmas began to develop, presents weren't a big thing. Gifts were not a major component of Christmas. Children got a little something. But basically, the gifts were hierarchical. Parents gave them to children, richer people gave them to poorer people. They weren't something that you gave to equals, and they weren't very big or important. So when the servants, as they did, of course, worked all of Christmas Day, they would get on the next day a little something from the people they worked for. But the people they worked for didn't have a big present tradition amongst themselves. So I think maybe when presents became a bigger thing, Boxing Day seemed to diminish in importance.
It's interesting, though, that the name still remains, and that even though it seems to have diminished in importance as a holiday itself, and now it's just a shopping holiday, as you say, that name is still there, and it still means something to somebody, I guess.
I think it does, but the English are very good on traditions and very good on sort of keeping names of things that you actually don't even really know what they mean anymore. it's sort of, you know, that there are so many layers of history. And it's just sort of part of daily life. We don't really think about it. Why is it called that?
So if you go back, can you tell me maybe some of the variations? We talked a little bit about, some of the smallish gifts, usually money, that were exchanged. But were there things like the MASH episode we talked about where people switched jobs or anything like
that?
Well, that's
interesting, because that comes from the much older tradition of the winter season. I mean, originally, of course, the Roman Saturnalia, where, you know, the fool becomes the king of mm-hmm. the season and so on. for a long time here, Twelfth Night, Epiphany on the 6th of January, was the big holiday. And they had the tradition then. There were a lot of, it was a much rougher holiday. And there was the tradition of the king and the queen of Twelfth Night. And you had it by, you had a Twelfth Night cake, and they had little tokens baked into them. And whoever got the slice with the token was the king or the queen. That gradually shifted as Christmas became more important, and it turned into a Christmas cake. But that older tradition of slightly rough, slightly streetish kind of holiday that your colleague thought Boxing Day might be was certainly a thing before the 19th century. So that was very much part of the season. But it's really only with the Industrial Revolution, with trains being able to take people home and refrigeration, which means you can get fresh food, that Christmas really turns into what we know. And therefore, Boxing Day begins to just be a little tag on. And the presents, I mean, by the way, the presents were really awful.
Tell us about them.
Either you just got money, which was good, of course. But I've seen advertisements from a department store where there were what were called servants' boxes. And it was ready made up, so you just bought the whole box. And it was fabric, lining, and thread and needle. So basically the servant could sew her own uniform.
Oh, that's nice.
Isn't that lovely? I wasn't supposed to tell you. You're going to get one.
Well, that is great, and that gives us something to think about as we go to the break right now. We're talking to Canadian historian and author Judith Flanders about the history of Boxing Day, and we'll continue our discussion in a minute. We'd like to hear from you.
Do you celebrate Boxing Day in some way, shape, or form? Have you lived in a country during Boxing Day? What did you do? Do you think we should celebrate it, and if so, how? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or if you've got your own day after Christmas traditions, Boxing Day or otherwise, let us know about that too. Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're picking up our conversation with historian and author Judith Flanders about Boxing Day.
Yeah, it's today, December 26th, the day after Christmas. And if you now or ever have celebrated Boxing Day, you can call and tell us about it. Have you made your own day after Christmas tradition? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
Judith Flanders, towards the end of your piece that was published in the New York Times, you make a case that where Boxing Day is now is one thing, but what we ought to be thinking about is sort of the origins of Boxing Day and the idea that giving is something worth considering, and more to the point, something worth actually taking action on, giving, whether it's a gift or of your time or money or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be not a bad tradition to have. It had traditionally been part of the teachings of the season, that one is charitable and one looks to others, and it doesn't seem like in these days of really conspicuous consumption, it's a bad idea.
So how do you think people react to it? I mean, at one point, we talked earlier about the sort of the wailing and gnashing and teeth in America, and you said it's been going on, since 1840. Lending your voice to this discussion had to be something you were thinking about for some time. Was there something that sort of pushed you over the edge and said, you know what, we got to get back to the past here and start thinking about where the origins of this came from?
Well, I think that traditionally, as I say, there had always been a component But part of it, of course, is if you read 19th century stuff and you realize how desperate the lives of so many were. I mean, people who were in full employment and considered themselves very fortunate. That we have a diary of a housemaid. And she wrote, without any self-pity at all, "I often think what a most delightful pleasure that must be, going home for Christmas, but I've never once had it." And we are so fortunate. We are so fortunate not to live in the 19th century, apart from anything else.
But
it's easy to forget how fortunate we are.
Yeah, and it sounds as though you may be drawing some parallels, and I don't know how directly they are, but that between the 19th century and now, in terms of, you know, the disparity that we hear about between rich and poor, and the time we spend doing good works and that sort of thing. I mean, are
it's
there
unavoidable? You can't read this stuff and not draw the parallels.
And so are you optimistic that someone will read your column and they will be, you know, all of a sudden it's going to be just like in a movie somewhere where all of a sudden the veil will lift and they'll start celebrating Boxing Day in the spirit with which it was intended? Or do you think it's going to be a long slog?
I don't think either. I mean, I don't think it's an either or. I don't think that, you know, either we get the panning vision of the snowflaked, blissed out family. Or Scrooge. I think it's probably somewhere in between. I think we're all somewhere in between. We would all like to do more, and mostly we don't.
So drawing on your work as an historian and taking a look back at the 19th century, and you said a few seconds ago that drawing those parallels between now and then are unavoidable, could outline some of those parallels for us, would you?
Well, the parallels are exactly that, to have a extraordinarily wealthy, very small segment at the top, to have a middle class which is getting, which was then not getting smaller but was very small, is now getting smaller. To have people who are politically disengaged because they don't feel they can make a difference, and so on and so forth. You know, large companies that take advantage of workers. I mean, I can go on forever. The 19th century, as a historian, you sit there and think, we've done this, please don't do this again. But the other day I was talking to another historian and said, do you feel the same? And he said, are you kidding me? I do the decline of the Roman Empire.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's like that. So did Boxing Day, you know, back in the day, it was designed at some level to, I guess, help those of a lesser rank, or maybe, you know, provide those of a higher rank with a little less guilt or something.
Well, this is precisely it. What you had in the 19th century was philanthropy or charity that was entirely privately organized. You had no social governmental structure that helped anyone. In Europe, in Canada, for the last 100 years, that has not been the case. We are returning, it would seem, to a situation where help is only provided by private charities.
And so given that, are you optimistic that a reminder of this Boxing Day tradition, the idea of it anyway, would help to maybe temper some of the excesses of the modern
day? No, I'm deeply pessimistic, but I'm deeply pessimistic by nature. I don't think, you know, one historian sitting and shrieking is going to make any difference at all. But at the same time, if none of us shriek, nothing happens.
And so do you feel as though you're shrieking alone? Are you a lone voice in the wilderness?
I think certainly, no, I don't think we are. I don't think so at all. I think there are many, many people who feel the same. It's what happens that I don't know. What changes are going to happen? What changes are possible? But I think there's certainly no harm in saying, look, we did this 150 years ago. It was really terrible.
So, taking that historical long view, what lessons can we learn? You've talked about some of the parallels and everything, but are there lessons that people should be taking to heart on this Boxing Day that they should be thinking about doing in terms of changing their lifestyle or changing or taking some sort of action or doing something, it sounds like you're saying, to help the common good?
This. I don't think you have to be a historian to point this out, that we live we do better when we live in communities where people help each other. It seems such an obvious thing that I don't think you have to have written a book on Victorian Britain to spot that one. I think that the reminder of what Boxing Day is can't hurt. That we take time out to think of those who are less fortunate can't hurt.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. And Judith Flanders, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us. And thanks for your explanations of Boxing Day. It's been a real education.
Thank you.
That was Canadian historian and author Judith Flanders. She is the author of The Invention of Murder and Inside the Victorian Home. Her opinion piece, Boxing Day is Forgiving, appeared in the New York Times.
And you can go online and share your seasonal holiday traditions, not just Boxing Day, but Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, up through New Year's. Is there something your family has done to reinvent it, to make it personal, or maybe just to work around the fact that not everybody can travel and be together on the holiday? Check us out on our various online incarnations. We're on Facebook, Central Time, on WPR. You can share your stories there. You can also tweet us. We're Central Time WPR. You can always email us, too, by the way, centraltime@WPR.org. I don't know why I have to stop and think so long on that one. It's pretty straightforward.
It's easy to get a hold of us. And if there are other holidays, other reasons to remember those in need during this time of the season, let us know about that too. We'd love to hear from you.